From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse studio. Thank you very much for joining us today. We're talking about community policing today, the interaction between the police and the community and vice versa, the community toward the police. And joining us to talk about it are people who are involved in this conversation in various ways professionally. We have two law enforcement officers with us, Chief Charles Ashbeck from Onalaska. Chief, welcome.
Thank you for inviting me here.
Absolutely. We've got Captain Jason Melby as well from the La Crosse Police Department. Captain Melby, thank you.
Thanks for having me today, Ezra.
And then joining us on the administrative side of that professional equation is the mayor of Viroqua, Mayor Karen Mitchell. Mayor Mitchell, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, thank you.
So we're talking about the interaction between police and our communities. A lot of it comes down to sort of the obvious run-of-the-mill things that we see every day in terms of patrols, traffic stops, just making sure everybody minds their P's and Q's and basic aspects of public safety. Let's start with Captain Melby as the professional standards and community services person at the La Crosse Police Department. Just talk about how you see the role of police in the community in 2021.
Well, obviously, one of the most important things from the aspect of our officers and our agency with our community is just the general engagement. If you aren't engaging with your community and hearing concerns and working with them to address issues that are important to the community, you're kind of out of touch. And you talked a little bit about the general functionality of you know, the policing, but it's more than that. It's more than just being out there and running radar and running traffic and keeping order. It's about actually connecting with your community and developing those relationships to keep everybody safe.
So Chief Ashbeck, to Captain Melby's point about it being bigger than, you know, just the things that we see as far as patrolling and all of that kind of thing, how do you go about building those relationships in a community like Onalaska?
Well, it starts with every interaction that we have. As Captain Melby said, it's really about building those relationships, and that's everything from, you know, any interaction, if we see somebody just in a store, to a police type action where we are addressing them and interacting with them as another human being, another community member, and respecting them and just building that rapport and those relationships right from the get-go.
Nobody likes to get stopped by the police. Nobody likes to get a ticket. A lot of the time when you see an officer walking toward you or driving toward your vehicle, the first reaction is not, here's a member of my community looking to connect with me. It's often more negative than that as far as people's perception. What's that? What's the opposite side of that coin for you, Chief Ashbeck or Captain Melby, when you're approaching a situation for the first time and getting involved in something that's going on? What does that feel like for you? The person you're approaching is wondering, oh no, what did I do? Or, oh no, what is this cop going to do to me? You know, what's that like from your side of the perspective?
That's why it's so important, our communication skills, when we interact with people, because you're right, people typically don't like to get pulled over by the police department. And so their anxiety level goes up and, you know, they're worried. And so when an officer first interacts with that person, you know, treating them with respect, you know, doesn't mean they can't be direct or maybe a little stern with them, but just explaining why they're there, the importance of what they're doing. 9 times out of 10, people understand and we can walk away from that traffic stop with a mutual understanding or mutual respect. They understand why we're trying to do our job. That's a big part of how we interact with the public, how we speak with people, our tone of voice, how we position ourselves, just how we present ourselves makes a big difference.
Captain Melby, can that be in spite of the fact that nobody does want to get a ticket? How do you take that circumstance and make it a positive experience?
The chief makes excellent points here. First and foremost is trying to have the people be at ease when you make that initial contact. You you understand as a law enforcement officer, the vast majority of times you're dealing with people who would prefer not to have to deal with you, right? So first and foremost is to put them at ease. And let's face it, everybody wants to know why. Taking a few seconds and explaining why you're there and what's going on and what led to you making contact with them can diffuse an entire situation. So just explaining the why for a lot of people means the world to them. And then they can respect why you're there. That resistance to provide that explanation sometimes can cause things to go sideways on minor issues. So making sure you're just simply explaining why you're making contact with them means the world to people.
We've seen like social media posts, videos, these kinds of things, not having to do with either of any of the departments represented here today, but people sometimes in a tense situation where somebody's even being arrested or something like that, and either them or one of their loved ones can often be seen saying, why is this happening? What are you arresting me for? That kind of thing. Are people owed an answer to that question immediately? Or like if an officer is in the middle of a tense situation and someone says, why are you arresting me? Like, do you have to tell them? Or is that like just a thing that you're saying should be a matter of courtesy?
Well, from my perspective and something I learned early on, well, I guess let me answer your question first. I don't think that we're required to tell them, but I think it's the right thing to do. And it boils down to, you know, when it's safe to do so, the officers should be explaining that. As Captain Melby said, just that short period of explanation goes a long ways. And that's what I learned early in my career is if we had to use some level of force against somebody, taking that extra couple of minutes afterwards to explain, this is why I had to do what I did, you know, goes a long way. And usually the person understood. And quite frankly, that usually lessened the amount of citizen complaints because they now understood why we did what we did. And so that went a long way.
Mayor Karen Mitchell is the mayor of Viroqua. Mayor Mitchell, you are not personally day-to-day responsible for law enforcement in your community as the mayor, but you do hire the police chief. The buck stops with your office in terms of how that aspect of your city runs. In a smaller community like Viroqua, talk about the relationship between your police department and the people.
Well, I think that's a very good point on the relationship of you know, my office and the police department. We've had the privilege recently of hiring a new police chief that was based his interview with us on community policing and the importance of community policing. And one thing that he has instilled in teaching me about the best practices of community policing is that the city of Viroqua and the city government, the elected officials, really our ultimate job is to make sure that we're providing a great quality of life for our residents. And community policing is just the basis of that. You know, through a good, solid, safe, trusting environment that our police officers can instill in our community just by being out there and people know them by name and being, you know, transparent and taking the time, like, you know, our other guests here have said, of just not, it's just because you don't have to doesn't mean you shouldn't. And that's one thing that we as a city government is so devoted to, is just making sure that they understand that the great relationship between the community members and our law enforcement can affect the quality of life beyond what you would think is, you know, obvious. And just to be able to create that confidence when somebody needs the police department, to have already built that trust and that reputation that they're not going to think twice about calling if they need it. And I think that's one thing that we learned last year, is the level, even in a small community, of often mistrust in our police department just based on what they've experienced or read or seen on the media, or, you know, and it's our job to make sure that we're we're building beyond that, and just kind of making sure that what's actually happening in our own backyards is the experience that our citizens can really share, not their perceptions based on you know, a bigger city, Milwaukee or Minneapolis. And that's very important. It's from my position to make sure that that's the message that we put out to our community.
One of the issues that faces any police department of any size are issues that have to do with people who are in mental health crisis. And in small towns, often police are called to handle these things almost exclusively. In other towns, there might be some combination of police, social workers might or might not be available to help in that regard, depending on the resources of each department. But talk about the challenge of discerning which, you know, which types of resources need to be made available to people who end up in the legal system who might better be treated in a mental health system. Mayor Mitchell, let's start with you and how that works in Viroqua.
Well, I will, you know, be honest that that's one thing that the city of Viroqua and even Vernon County struggles with. In the last couple of years, we lost our task force that was able to respond and deal with those things. And it does fall solely now on the police department. And that's a continued conversation that we're having as a city government moving forward, is trying to figure out how as a city we make room in our budget or to work with the county and other area organizations to fill that need. Because so many times our officers are occupied for more of their shift, you know, and it carries on for beyond just one day on one call. And could that be mitigated by having a mental health professional stepping in earlier? And it's definitely something that we don't have an answer to yet of how we're going to fix this problem. But it's certainly a discussion that we recognize more and more of the scope, the broad scope of everything that entails, but taking resources away from our police department and time when they're having to take a patient hours away, it's taking our officers off of their patrol as well. And so we're having that discussion, but we certainly don't have the answers for that in our small community yet.
We've seen people calling for funding that is directed toward police departments, some of that funding to be redirected toward mental health services, toward more social workers, those kinds of things, saying that a police force is not the appropriate entity to be dealing with some of these things. Captain Melby, do you feel like your department has the resources that it needs in terms of dealing with mental health crises?
You know, the interesting aspect of this is none of us here in law enforcement want to see mental health issues be criminalized. But the fact of the matter is, when it's 2:30 in the morning and there's somebody going through a mental health crisis, it is the law enforcement officers of your community that are working that are going to get dispatched to them. And we do need the tools. We do need the help. There are some best practice models out there that if the funding was available, we would love to have a co-responder model where there's social workers teamed with law enforcement to respond and deal with these situations. But the way many of our systems are already built and established, it puts us on the front lines to go and triage a situation, attempt to de-escalate it, and then bring it down to a level where we can start determining what the best course of action is at that point. And no, I won't say that even a community of La Crosse's size has all the resources that we need to address this effectively. We struggle on a daily basis to meet the needs of those who have got are in mental health crisis. What we can do, though, internally is continue to train our officers to de-escalate these situations. We can train our officers to identify the signs of mental health crisis and how to best bring them down to a level where we can start getting them the help they need and then focus on it from there.
That's Captain Jason Melby of the La Crosse Police Department. We're also talking today with Chief Charles Ashbeck from Onalaska and Mayor Karen Mitchell from Viroqua. Our conversation continues in just a moment. If you'd like to revisit part of this conversation that you might have missed, or if you'd like to listen to a previous episode of our program, you can find them all on our website. It's WPR.org/newsmakers, and we'd love to have you join us there. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse studio. Thank you very much for joining us for our conversation about the relationship between police and the community. And we're joined by three guests today. Chief Charles Ashbeck is the chief of police in Onalaska. We've got Captain Jason Melby, who is with the Professional Standards and Community Services Bureau in the La Crosse Police Department. And we have Mayor Karen Mitchell, who is the mayor of Viroqua. And I appreciate all of them joining us today to talk about police. One of the issues that has been a topic of conversation on this show and on so many other programs in even greater depth across the last year or so is the relationship between police and Black, Indigenous, and people of color in our communities. And as hard as I know that you all have talked about working to maintain positive relationships in the community, there are some people in our area who just feel like they have experienced a lifetime of negative interactions with not just police in our area, but just wherever they happen to have lived, and that this is a very, very widespread issue for a lot of folks. Chief Ashbeck, let's start with you on this one. What has to happen when there's such a disconnect between the real lived experiences of some individuals and a police department who might not feel as though that description of how they're treating people is accurate?
Well, I think it comes down to what we talked about earlier, is building those relationships. You know, we can understand where people, you know, may be feeling that way and why they're feeling that way, so that we can become aware of that. And so if there's things that we can do to change or communicate better, change our practices in a different way so that we are not, you know, continually perpetuating that type of perceived discrimination or other behaviors that tend to make people like that afraid of the police department or fear the police department, I think we need to just continue to bring people together and bring, you know, with our departments together and have those conversations, have staff learn about those differences, you know, maybe the unconscious biases that we all have. The more we can become aware of those things, you know, will help us in future interactions with people of various minorities or marginalized people.
You mentioned unconscious biases, and that's one of the issues that I wanted to bring up with each of you regarding your departments, because you know, there's training available to help people recognize their own unconscious biases or implicit biases, and yet a lot of people think that because they don't experience bad emotions or hateful emotions and that kind of thing when addressing people of color, that they aren't biased or that they, you know, don't act in ways that could be construed to be racist. So first of all, does your department offer that kind of unconscious bias training, and what kind of changes have you been able to see in people who have been through that sort of exercise, Chief?
Well, we do have various diversity type trainings every year, although I will admit it is a struggle to find that type of training to bring in. We did have over, I think, last summer and fall, Captain Melby can probably set me straight, but there was some area training that did dive into this topic of unconscious bias. It was part of the UW La Crosse's kind of a pilot program. We had numerous officers go through that program, as well did La Crosse and several other agencies in the area. So that has certainly helped bring up or bring conversations up internally talking with each other about these, but it is something that we definitely have more work to do, and we need to continue to have these conversations or try to find trainings to bring into our area so that we can expose our officers to these topics.
Captain Melby, about either the training that Chief Ashbeck just mentioned or other opportunities that have been made available in La Crosse, what are the trainings that are available to officers in La Crosse as far as tending to their own potential biases?
First and foremost, we've got several instructors within our department in the area of fair and impartial policing. And one of the heavy focuses in the fair and impartial policing curriculum is recognizing the aspect of biases, both of the officer and of the community. So, as a servant of the community, we are responding to a lot of calls, and I would say 80% plus of our calls are based on a call for service that we respond to. And we have to navigate those waters of other people's implicit biases. So we focus on that, number one. Number two is the training that Chief Ashbeck just talked about. It was a human rights policing course. It was a pilot course through UWL that we participated in. It was a four-week course developed by a UWL professor, and many of the law enforcement from the local community attended that. Just today, we're in the middle of our in-service, and we did a fair and impartial policing booster for our officers as part of our in-service. The research on these implicit bias trainings is that it's just not enough to teach it once, okay? You have to have continual boosters of this type of training to keep it in the to the front of the officer's mind. Now, it's just, you have to be conscious that you have these biases. People develop these biases naturally throughout their own life experiences, and not allowing those biases to influence your decisions when you're out there taking enforcement action or dealing with people in a law enforcement capacity is what's important. And teaching our officers to understand that it's okay to have biases. Everybody has them, but they can't allow those biases to dictate how they do their job. And then there was one last training. We just completed a training with the YWCA on racial justice workshop. We just completed a four-week course. Most of our administration, our neighborhood resource officers, our school resource officers, so somewhere in the area of 25% of our agency just completed training in the YWCA racial justice workshop. So the one thing I would say is that law enforcement needs to look outside of its own professional area to identify the areas where these trainings are being offered. The chief brought up a good point that finding them are difficult. Finding good quality trainings are difficult. That's why we partnered with UWL for the pilot project and partnered with YWCA for the racial justice workshop. Because if you continue to just use your own police training, it can lend itself to people looking at it and saying, well, yeah, you're just doing police trainings though.
To Captain Melby's point about the availability of these trainings, I can imagine Mayor Mitchell in a town like Viroqua that is perhaps a little bit isolated and with maybe a smaller force, a smaller budget, these things might be harder to come by. What does a department like yours have to do when it comes to finding training for either implicit bias or any of the other matters of making sure that police are equipped to have the tools they need to do their jobs the best way that they can?
Sure. I think, Viroqua is small and our budget is small, but we also, we face many of the same situations that have already been brought up here. It's just finding those trainings, right? And being able to have more available to us. There are internal conversations that we have at the police department. Earlier in the year, the city of Viroqua sponsored a public meeting, and it was myself and our new police chief, Rick Niefeldt, and we had hired a professional facilitator from Nurturing Diversity Partners in Milwaukee to come in and facilitate a conversation with our community to really open ourselves up and be transparent, and they could ask us anything about the policies of the police department, different ways that we see bias and in our own prejudices, and really to share the experiences with us, and really let our community let us know what their concerns are. And through that, we have decided then the city of Viroqua is working on creating a diversity board. And much of the basis of the diversity board is to be very transparent and communicating with the police department. What are their protocols? We had concerns brought up about why are the police departments, the officers, the first to arrive when I called for a fire call? And then it made some people feel uncomfortable. And we also have internal conversations at the police department to just recognize that many of these folks that come with preconceived ideas or fears towards the police when they show up, are people of color, marginalized members of our community, that everybody brings their own past experiences and traumas that we might not even recognize when we arrive. And so we also have those internal conversations because the training's not always there, but it's something that Viroqua is very outspoken and passionate about what they want us to know. And we, as a police department and a community, are doing our best right now to create a safe space for people to bring those concerns to us, but also very transparent and open door policy with our police department. That if you want to talk to us about anything, please come and we will come and meet you. The chief and I have gone and met with people in the community who had concerns about past experiences. And I think that's the best we can do is just make ourselves vulnerable and really listen because, you know, like was mentioned already, we all have biases and prejudices that we just need to be able to recognize and move forward once we know better.
Captain Melby, we were talking in the first part of our conversation, we used the term community policing, and Mayor Mischel talked about that as a strategy that they're using in Viroqua, and obviously a lot of police departments are now engaging in that as a specific law enforcement strategy as opposed or maybe in addition to the other things that they used to do. But people might have heard that term over and over again and not have a real understanding of what's involved in that. As sort of a law enforcement theory or in terms of a relationship building theory with the community, what is community policing? And talk about how that's affected your work in the La Crosse Police Department.
I think Chief Ashbeck, when he answered a question about this a little earlier, specifically said it starts with that just daily contact, okay? And I would take it just a little bit further. It's the philosophy of the agency, of how their officers are supposed to police the community. There's a lot of departments out there that have got community policing programs. They've got a couple officers assigned to it. They go out and they do community relations. And we've got that. We've got our neighborhood resource officer program. But it's not enough just to have a program. You need to train it into the new officers when they come into this department. And it's a manner with which they're going to interact with the community on a daily basis, not just for National Night Out when there's block parties, or not just for this event or that event. It needs to be the daily function. It needs to be how you approach citizens on a regular basis. So I would say it's more of a philosophy than a program. And that's where a lot of agencies need to start. And that's what it should look like on a daily basis for an agency, including the La Crosse Police Department, is our officers out there doing the little things that develop the relationships on a daily basis, and not just every now and then we have a couple officers show up at a program and call it community policing.
So it's more about adopting that as a model for the whole department rather than just a small faction of officers dedicated to that kind of one-off activity.
Yeah, and engaging your community to participate with you in keeping the community safe. It's everything we do on a daily basis. The one thing I would assert as a law enforcement professional today, much of our socialization within our communities is occurring on social media platforms. I would say that our social media platform is a form of community policing at this point. We engage our community, we communicate with our community. We show the community that our officers are human through that platform. So it's even beyond just the officers out in the squad cars, it's how we communicate on a daily basis with our community.
Let me ask you, as closing, in closing, I'd like to go down the line. We'll start with Chief Ashbeck from Onalaska. I want to ask each of you sort of a next steps type of question. What is the most important next step in terms of continuing to build better relationships between the police and the communities that they serve?
I think, like the mayor had mentioned, transparency is a great first step, and continuing to be transparent with our community members so that we can, you know, continue to build trust or even start to build trust with those that don't trust us. And then just looking for opportunities to continue to partner with various groups or individuals, host conversations, you know, events just like this where we can have these conversations, I think are important, because community members that listen to this can get some perspective of what our perspective is. And then hopefully we can have continuing dialogue of what our community wants. And so just looking for those opportunities, both externally and then opportunities internally with our staff through various trainings, and just continuing to grow, keep those conversations alive.
Captain Melby, what about you? What's the most important next step that you see coming down the pike?
You know, I look at it, and one of the terms that keeps coming up is relationships. Relationships are work. We all know that. I look at the relationship with my wife, and we have to work on it. And so as we move forward, we have to continue to do the hard work of an agency of identifying how we can strengthen the relationship with our community. Sections of our community who just don't trust us. We have to figure out how to bridge those gaps. We've got to figure out what events and what manners we can come to our areas of community that maybe aren't anxious to develop that relationship with us. And how do you break down those walls to get the communication going? Because it's one thing for the department to just say they want to develop a relationship, but there's real work there to do it. And I think the next steps are really on a regular basis, not just a one-time initiative, but a regular basis working to achieve those relationships, not a one-time event. And I think it's just continual hard work.
Mayor Mitchell, what about Viroqua? You said you've hired a new police chief. You mentioned off the air that you're in the process of building a new police department, and you've been able to hire another officer. Talk about what is next in terms of improving those relationships with the community that we've been talking about.
Well, I think that the biggest thing for us is just to continue to create a culture in our department that the community is our biggest priority. And yes, through having a much larger new department that's in a better location, we'll be able to have events where we can reach out to the community and let them come and meet us. But really what it comes down to as a city and as a police department in the city of Viroqua, we need to be the ones to make the first move. We need to be the ones to reach out to our communities and let them know that we are here and be proactive and not just reactive, waiting to address a concern or something happened and we want to, you know, make the record straight. We find it very important that we reach out and we meet our citizens where they're at. And that can be really uncomfortable, but it can also be incredibly rewarding. And I think just having conversations like this and sharing ideas with other departments and other communities, and just being able to continue the conversation and all learning from each other through our shared experiences is really the next step. It's just continuing to go forward.
Karen Mitchell is the mayor of Viroqua. Mayor Mitchell, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Captain Jason Melby from the La Crosse Police Department. Captain Melby, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate the time.
Chief Charles Ashbeck is the chief of police in Onalaska. Chief, thank you very much for your time.
Yes, thank you for inviting me and giving me the opportunity to be here.
Absolutely. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall. If you'd like to catch up this episode again or part of our conversation or a previous conversation that you might have missed, you can find them on our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. The program continues in just a moment. It's Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. From Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our La Crosse studio. Thank you very much for joining us today. An interesting conversation to close out today's show. We're speaking with Professor Greg Parmeter from the Theater Department at the University of Wisconsin La Crosse. First of all, Professor Parmeter, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And you have come up with a very interesting project this year, and it is COVID-related, and we'll get into that a little bit later, but you've come up with a play that is based on the work by Molière called The Misanthrope. Let's start our conversation by talking about The Misanthrope for those who are not familiar with it. I know it's impossible to sum up in like 2 minutes, but can you give us the elevator speech of what The Misanthrope is?
Yes, I sure can, because I've had to do this. So The Misanthrope is one of Molière's great comedies. And of course, it's about a man who just is very misanthropic, meaning he doesn't like people. He's not happy about the world around him. And one of the things that upsets him is the falseness and the dishonesty that's inherent in his culture and his society. And it leads him to be very sort of what we would now call brutally honest, but in reality, just cruel to people around him, very unforgiving of faults, very judgmental. And he's in love with a woman who embodies all of the things that he claims to hate. And so there's this dichotomy between what he says and what he does and the hypocrisy of living in this aristocratic society. And so there was a lot of connection between, you know, living your life on social media and the society of Molière's time. And it seemed to be the exact kind of play that was ripe for updating and bringing into the now.
So you say the comparison there for you was you didn't say the word obvious, but it seems like you were implying is sort of obvious. I think a lot of people think of Molière and go, what has that to do with social media? Talk about how your mind kind of connected those dots.
Well, so when we conceived the project as a department originally, what we wanted was to be able to find some safe ways for our students to be able to explore theater. So that was our first priority. And last semester, we had done a couple of radio style plays that we recorded and streamed. But with the uncertainty of what was going to be safe in terms of distancing and space, we conceived the idea of, can we produce a play entirely over Zoom, rehearsal, performance, everything. So we started there. And then the search began to sort of find the play that worked. And ultimately, I decided that the play needed to be something that was written with Zoom in mind, so that the medium was part of the message and part of the style of the play. So I started looking at, okay, let's create something. And the idea of crafting a completely new play out of nothing like terrified me, because I'm not a playwright. I'm an actor and I'm a director. So I've done a lot of work with Molière, and I happen to adore The Misanthrope. And one of the things that is really apparent in Molière's society and in his works is this inherent difference between our private face and our public face. And thinking about that and going, okay, Molière's society has a lot in common with the way we live on social media in this day and age, whereas we have these public personas on these, you know, TikToks, Instagram, Facebook, where we give like the rosy picture of who we are and what our life is like. You know, you Instagram your food and you take these pictures of these incredible meals, regardless of how well they taste or whether you crafted it. And my big frustration is watching like parents of my own age with young children sort of crafting these images of the perfect family and the perfect childhood and being the perfect parent, which I find annoying as all get out, because we understand the real messy side of being a parent, of raising children. The lead in Molière's play, Alceste, is dealing essentially with social media of his day, which is, here's the facade, here's what I'm going to present to the public, here's what I'm going to say versus what I actually do. And so in that, I found the parallels of society to be really compelling. And I went, this plot is strong enough that it can be adapted to today and still have something to say to our targeted audience, which, you know, is really our students here at the university, both who are theater students, but those students on the larger campus that aren't necessarily studying theater. What do we have to say to them? What can we offer them about the world that they're living in? So making it a play that entirely takes place on Zoom meetings, a series of four Zoom meetings, and deals with the issues of social media and how we communicate with one another, especially today in the pandemic, became sort of the hook for creating the play.
It's interesting that it's almost like what we've been going through creates an opportunity to talk about the facade that we all put on. Because who among us hasn't had, you know, the suit jacket on top and the jogging shorts on the bottom, you know, like all year long? You know, the dog is barely out of the frame, and you know, you have all kinds of chaos going on just on the other side of the camera. But you're trying to present this face of yourself that is what you think of as the most presentable. Talk about getting this cast together. How many roles do we have here? What's the makeup of the students who are going to be performing?
So we have a cast of 9. And there's 5 women and 4 men. And this is a group that has not been in the same space with each other at all during this process. Because even the auditions, they would come in to audition one at a time, and then our callbacks are done over Zoom. So I've got 9 student actors. I've got 2 student stage managers. I've got a student who is my assistant director. And we are now in our 3rd week of rehearsal, and we have never shared a space together, which is terrifying from a theatrical standpoint, where we are so used to the collaborative atmosphere of being in a room together and playing and bouncing off ideas and working physically. It's part of the nature of what we do. But it's like you said, there is opportunity in the challenges that we're facing. And theater artists have been doing this for centuries, you know, creating work in a pandemic, you know, creating work when the world is falling apart around us. And so to watch these students be able to say, okay, here are the skills that we have, here's the knowledge that we have, this is completely different than any sort of acting we've ever done, and watch them adapt so much quicker to this environment than me or some of the other faculty who are working as designers and technicians on the show. They're incredibly resilient, these students, and I'm discovering that their creativity knows no bounds. And really, the students drove the genesis of this project, because the conversation amongst us was, do we cancel our spring season? Do we try to find small little projects for the students to do? And our students were adamant that no, they wanted to continue to create theater. The difference is we needed to expand and adapt what that definition of theater was going to be, which is really scary for those of us who have been working in the field and have gone through our training process. And we have very strict sort of, this is what theater is, this is what theater is supposed to be. And to watch them go, yeah, no, but we don't have to stick to those definitions. We can expand and we can create something. So watching them sort of embrace this new process and this new reality and still feel that desire to create and to connect with one another is really amazing and exciting. So, you know, it's the Brady Bunch. We've got all the heads on the screens and they're interacting with the camera, but at the same time playing these beautiful and wonderful scenes with one another, you know, across miles and miles. You know, I've got some that are in the same dorm. I have some students that are in Holman and being here in La Crosse. So they're all over the place, yet that ability of theater to bring people together and to connect people is what's going to be really powerful about this whole process.
So how much of Molière is left here? Your play is called Influence. How much of Molière is left? How much Greg Parmenter do we have here?
Oh, that's the million-dollar question, isn't it?
You're a theater professor. It's going to be nowhere near $1 million. You know that.
Yeah, I know, right? But if anyone wants to, I can be bought.
Right?
So the basic plot and the basic genesis of these characters, I think, still are being pulled from Molière. But obviously, the language is all new. I played for a while for the first couple of weeks trying to write this thing of doing a line-by-line, you know, update and translation of Molière until I figured that wasn't going to work anymore, because I wasn't putting this on the stage where I knew this was going to be on the screen and I knew this was going to be in a Zoom meeting. that conceit had to go because it was just going to be one more barrier between my audience and the material. So not as much of Molière exists any longer in the play beyond it is the inspiration for the plot, but even those details had to be changed. So now it definitely is in the realm of mostly my words, but the inspiration and the idea really still lives in the world of Molière and the Misanthrope. And the cast actually has had quite a bit of input in say into developing the language and the scenes and the characters, because being a 41-year-old man, I'm not Gen Z, and I don't understand how they use the lingo. It's, you know, I may understand the lingo, but understanding it and knowing what they're talking about when you're speaking to them versus writing it are two very, very different things. So there's actually a lot of my students in this play as well.
It must be interesting. You know, you were talking about just having come up in this traditional theatrical environment where the players are all interacting with each other, and it's such a collaborative thing, and that's where the energy comes from. Not to mention the audience who's right there, and every single performance is a different thing because of a different audience. But these kids are raised in, I mean, you've got students that are 18, 19, 20 years old now, they don't know life without this digital space that we all exist in. So do you think that makes it easier for them to adapt to something like this than maybe somebody your age or mine?
Yes, absolutely. Because they're used to communicating in a digital method, whereas I've had to learn. And so there's an innate understanding and an innate flexibility of being young and in that process of being a student that demands that sort of flexibility. And we talk about flexibility and adaptability as being, you know, some of the greatest skills that an actor can possess. And it isn't until you're forced to confront a situation like this that you realize that, oh, okay, I'm not as flexible as I used to be. These, you know, you start to understand your parents a little bit more when you get there. But to watch them do it. And, you know, I thought their ability to connect was going to be hampered because of this medium of, you know, trying to speak to one another through a camera and across distance. But we had this beautiful moment at rehearsal last night where there's six boxes on the screen and six actors and one person speaking, and to watch and to be able to see how they're listening and how they're letting these words affect their expression and where they're looking and their body language. I was like, oh, okay, this is some really beautiful acting that's happening in a venue where, you know, I was frightened to sort of go into this project, especially because we set ourselves up some difficult challenges, not the least of which is this is not going to be strictly a recorded and streamed performance. Our first week of performances for this are going to be live, so that the audience will tune in and they will be experiencing this play as it's happening in the moment with these actors. And it's one of the things I'm most excited about with this particular piece of theater is it's a little bit closer to being in a theater and having that sense of communion between actor and audience and actor and one another.
So let's get the particulars. When are these performances going to be, and how can people find ticket information?
So the performances are the live streaming, where the audience can tune in if they want to be part of the live event. Those performances are March 10th through the 13th and March 14th. So March 14th is a matinee. And then the weekend following will be when they'll be streamed. And so you can get the recorded version and go. The best way to get tickets is actually go to our website, go to uwlax.edu and click on the theater webpage, and there'll be the link there for tickets and all of that.
Okay, good deal. Greg Parmeter is a theater professor at the University of Wisconsin-La Crosse. Greg, thank you very much for this conversation and for involving your students in a really interesting project. I can't wait to see it.
Me too. It's been exciting to work on, and I owe a big debt of gratitude to the theater department on campus for supporting this and our students for pushing us to do these kinds of projects.
Yes, indeed. And thanks for being with us on Newsmakers today.
Thank you.
This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall. Thank you very much for joining us today. If you'd like to hear today's program again, you can find it and all the rest of them on our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. Dawn Jewell and John Davis helped produce the show, and I thank them for that. For the rest of our La Crosse staff, I hope you'll join us next time for another Newsmakers right here on Wisconsin Public Radio.